Norman Stories, written by Norman and read by Norman. After my first marriage had broken up, I decided to concentrate on becoming an actor. I had auditioned at a drama college, and much to my surprise, I was accepted. And so the 2-year course began. Afterwards, I realized that getting an agent and my first job was not going to be easy. So, with a few other students, we set up our own company, calling it the Shakespeare Players. We did a short season in London in a very small theatre, and while playing Orlando in As You Like It, I was spotted and given a 7-year film contract by MGM, never having yet been on a professional stage. So my next story is about my first job as a professional actor. It's called Fit-Ups. After 2 years of drama school, I was now equipped to become a leading man in whatever play should be lucky enough to have me. I was able to speak correctly, move correctly, and I had studied the drama. Hadn't I already been discovered and put under contract by MGM before I'd even been on a professional stage? Prepared as they were to pay me a weekly salary, whether I worked or not, this was certainly the right profession for me. My agent would groom me for a successful career. "You've got a good smile," he said, "so keep using it." A habit I took years to get out of. The weeks went by, then months, and the only theatres I seemed to get near to were the ones I had to pay to get in. The actors I met only at parties, and it was the first time of many bad patches. One day, that phone did ring, and my agent's voice said, "I'm sending you to Ireland. They want a young leading man for a touring company, and you're just right. They pay £7 a week, and you leave the day after tomorrow. Come into the office, and I'll give you your boat ticket." "Do they know I've never acted professionally before?" I said. "Yes, I've explained all that, and they seem to be happy with it." I felt excited and absolutely terrified. And as I put down the phone, the old actor's insecurity came pouring over me. I didn't really deserve that contract. I had a good working-class face, and working-class faces were in because working-class writers were in. "They'll send me back on the next boat train as soon as I open my mouth," I feared. Ah, hell, I didn't want to be an actor anyway. I was much more interested in directing. The boat train to Ireland was long and cold. My agent seemed very vague about the whole thing and had no idea what the plans were, only that I would be met in Dublin and the whole thing would be explained. Not only did I feel that I was in the deep end, but I was already under and spluttering. I was met by a sparkling lady of about 35, whose Irish accent burred above the noise of the station. She somehow recognised me, and I recognised in her the warmth and motherliness that was to accompany me for the next 3 months. She was a member of the cast and would be driving me to County Clare, where we were to start the tour. She was a singer, she said, who played the accordion, and wouldn't consider herself in any way to be an actress. As we drove through the rich Irish countryside, Jessie explained that I would be joining what they called a fit-up, a very popular form of entertainment in Ireland. I'm surprised you've never heard of it. You will be doing a different play every night, starting with a little entertainment, you know, a few gags and a bit of singing. It gets them in a good mood. And we finish with a short sketch, and now that's always fun to do. My silence must have worried her, because she quickly told me that they were all a grand bunch and we would have a lovely time together. That seemed to be the most important thing. And In a way, I agreed. But it wasn't exactly what I had in mind. We arrived in Kildare by the evening and went straight to the pub where I was to stay, a typical Irish country pub with lots of heavy wood and dark corners. Patrick Dawson, the actor and manager, came and introduced himself and his wife, a professional actress, an intense girl from London who seemed completely out of place. Patrick, on the other hand, was typically Southern Irish, long dark features, a real playboy of the Western world. We drank Guinness while the others joined us. Kathy, a young actress from Dublin, in her mid-20s, who wanted to dance. Sylvia, who danced jigs, but wanted to act. Paddy the pianist, whose shy red cheek shone after only one glass and kept himself to himself. And Jack, an old hand at playing melodramas at 55, who was never short of words. Not knowing what to expect from each other, we all felt awkward. Patrick explained that we would all travel around in a lorry and would play any village in the area that would provide an audience. We would start in 2 days' time in Kildare with His Mother's Rosary, an Irish melodrama that would always bring in a good house. "You're playing John the Blacksmith, the leading character," I was told. "Don't worry," Patrick's wife Jean said as she saw the worried look on my face. "You have 2 whole days with the script, and as everyone else knows the play backward, they will carry you. It's not like working in England, you know." And how right she was. The next morning the script was waiting for me, a school notebook with the play scrawled in pencil by a childlike hand, almost illegible. I waded through it over breakfast, a naive melodrama that could be played only one way, and that was for as many tears as the audience carried. Rehearsals at 2 in the village hall, where we were to open, didn't start until 3:30. I hadn't yet heard of Irish time. We walked through the play with Patrick directing and playing all the parts. But after a couple of hours, everyone seemed to get bored, so we all retired to the pub. The whole cast would be on stage, knees high, arms swinging, singing, "If you're Irish, come into the parlour." When we finished, exit right and left, Norman will come back, feed Patrick his jokes. An Irish jig with Sylvia, followed by Patrick singing a rebel song, complete with blood-stained bandage on his head, hands clutching at heaven as he sprawled on the floor, dying for Ireland, guaranteed to bring the house down every night. By this time I was on curtain pulling. Jesse would play the accordion and sing sweet songs. And then away we would go into the melodrama, followed by our sketch. The show would take 2.5 hours. Opening night was a great success, with a full house going along with everything we did. The more you played the melodrama, the more they enjoyed it, often joining in. Strutting about the stage with a 14-pound hammer on my shoulder, trying to remember the plot, I would be asked by Patrick where I was having tea that evening, a fact that I'd forgotten to mention, where a bloody deed was going to take place. I very quickly explained that it was at my grandma's I was going to have my tea, and I was on my way there right now. I learned a repertoire of 4 or 5 plays in this way, and we used to alternate them, and I became an expert in ad-libbing like the rest. We travelled around in our open-top lorry, perched on top of all the stage gear, and if it rained, we had to cover up the piano quickly before it rusted. Arriving at a new village, we would fit up on the hall stage and prepare for the evening show. If we were playing East Lynne, a search would have to be made for a young girl to play the dying daughter. Dead and never called me mother. Always good for business, this one, as everyone in the village were related to each other, and all the cousins, uncles, and aunts would be dragged along to see their little girl making her professional debut, as Patrick held a bicycle torch in her face, while all around we wept. Finding a place to stay was never a problem, as the Irish like a bit of company, and they would gladly put us up. We stayed on farms, where a good chat would go on till 3 or 4 in the morning, in front of large fireplaces, with the pot always boiling over the fire. No matter where we went, we were always fed the same food. Potatoes, boiled in their jackets, boiled cabbage, and boiled ham. I lived on that diet for 3 months. The show was advertised to start at 7:30, but we never pulled the opening curtain before 9. A rocket would go off about 8 to hurry them up with their teas, and I would take the tickets or be in charge of the records which were played before the show. I never looked at what record was playing, as one Irish jig sounded the same as another to me. I once unexpectedly put on the Irish national anthem by mistake, and Patrick came rushing backstage, swearing it was intentional. Then did I understand why the audience were sheepishly staggering to their feet. Now, Patrick liked his Guinness and was at it most of the time during the show. He would often nip out for a quick one and swear he'd be back in time for pulling the curtain or whatever else it was he had to do. Many a time you would be left with your last line in Sweeney Todd, arm around the young maiden, fist raised to heaven, and we shall never fear the demon of Fleet Street again. But no curtain. You would try it again. And we shall never fear the demon of Fleet Street again. After the 3rd time, you would know that Paddy had mistimed his return, which meant you had to walk off and pull the curtain down yourself. In East Lynne, with the villainous squire not getting his way with Maria, slowly, to the audience's horror, you would take out your revolver, take aim, and as Maria rushed off stage crying, "No, no!" Patrick would hopefully be there to make the sound of the gun going off. But if he again mistimed his return from the pub, you were left to say bang, as Maria came back on stage covered in blood. We spent our days riding the farmers' traps, or cycling or walking on the hills, or visiting farms where we sat in dark kitchens while the butter was churned, bread was made, and mead was drunk. There was no television. And apart from perhaps twice a year when the travelling cinema came around, we were the only entertainment and the only theatre they had ever seen. Almost every night, something seemed to go wrong in the show, but the audience never seemed to mind or even notice. When I fed Patrick the jokes, often the girl would put a different number on my side of the stage, so that I would come and feed Patrick number 6 joke, and he would come back answering number 7, which didn't make sense at all. But one night, the audience did notice. As the play was in progress, and yet another backcloth had been rolled down to change the scene, the audience started to titter. And it wasn't until we saw scrawled in large letters, F off, on the cloth, did we understand what was going on. Some young boy had got in before the show and proved to us that he could spell. Jean and Patrick's rows became part of our everyday life, especially if business had slowed down or if Patrick had gone on to the whiskey. Often during a show you would have to top their shouting backstage or the painted backcloth would suddenly spring forward as Patrick gave his wife a shove during a row. But one day, it was decided that we should add a prestige show to our repertoire, and smiling through a First World War tearjerker would be just the thing. Real scripts from French's, the theatrical publishers in London would be used, and real rehearsals, directed by Patrick's wife, whose idea the whole thing was, would begin as soon as they arrived. Patrick even stopped drinking for a while, and was like a boxer preparing for a big fight. We were handed our scripts one morning, and eagerly rushed to our rooms to read the play. We emerged all agreeing that it was just right for the audiences we were playing to. Rehearsals went well, and as we learned our lines, I felt for the first time that I was in a professional company. Jean tried hard to direct, as well as play the leading lady, Kathleen, but it soon became clear that Patrick wasn't having any of her direction, and the bickering and the rows began again. Patrick would rush out to the pub, cursing all women, especially English ones. As he was our second leading man, doubling up with two parts, as we all did, it became worrying, to say the least, whether he would make it before the grand opening. But make it he did, if only in body, as he stoked up on the whiskies, and the most glorious row of rows broke out halfway through the play. Patrick announced to the cast that he was going to kill his wife, and chased her out of the side door into a field, and as far as I know, never caught up with her. In the meantime, the play went on, and I sent Jack to keep talking as long as he could, while I shouted to this insane couple that they were to come and finish the play. They were oblivious to my appeals, so I decided to go back and last as long as we could without them. I staggered on stage, a cripple, having just returned from the war front. With Jack sitting on one side and I on the other of the overdone garden setting, we frantically ad-libbed everything we could think of, from Catholicism to the IRA, glancing hopefully at the wings, to be rescued from our ridiculous situation. Jack had sent Kathleen to America before I arrived, so we seemed to have plenty of time on our hands. And to our amazement, the audience seemed to follow everything we said as part of the play. I knew we couldn't stay there all night, so after a while, I staggered to my feet and loudly proclaimed that if Kathleen had gone to America, then I was going to America to find her. And as I started to shuffle off the stage with the idea of simply bringing down the curtain to end this madness, Jack, with a wild acclaim, shouted, "Just a minute!" He rushed to the other side of the stage and with a grand gesture cried, "There's a light in Kathleen's window! She's back." And there was Jean, standing in the wings, hair and mud all over her face, smiling. We both sat down again, turned the play back to where it should have been, gave Jean her cue to come on, and we all finished the play to loud applause. Not one person who I asked afterwards knew anything had gone wrong. "Well, I must say I heard a bit of a noise going on there for a while," someone said. But that was all. As business got worse, Patrick decided to join the IRA and brought a Mac with a high collar and announced that a very important meeting of the lads would be taking place in a field not far from where we were. Lieutenants from Dublin and perhaps 200 or 300 others would be attending. When I expressed a wish to go along and hear what it was all about, Patrick hit the roof. They only have to hear an English voice and the whole crowd would go berserk, he said, and made me promise to stay in my room for the whole day and arrange for my food to be sent up. For days, he could be seen in dark corners, whispering, and occasionally the word Guardia would be mentioned, and a lot of Guinness would be taken by all. When the big day arrived, I stayed in my room above the pub as promised, only glancing out of the window to catch a glimpse of the big men from Dublin. But I saw no one. It was unnervingly quiet as I waved to my friends on their way to church, who seemed to be going about their business as usual. I couldn't imagine what was going on in that field, and it did occur to me that surely the police would get a little suspicious if suddenly 200 or 300 strangers in Macs would descend on a sleepy little town. Eventually, I heard Patrick's drunken voice in the bar and made my way down to hear all. "Well, you see, Norman," he said, "there was a bit of a problem. There was only me and this other fellow who turned up. And after waiting a few hours, we decided to have a couple of jars instead." I left the show after 3 months, but in that time I'd come to love the Irish and their crazy ways. I had been introduced to J.M. Singh by the lovely Kathleen, the Catholic who never did. I arrived with a closed mind, but was leaving with an open one.